This is the first instalment of a five-part interview with Cory Doctorow, conducted by Rachel Baker and Charles Beckett of Arts Council England. Baker and Beckett quiz Cory on publishing, Creative Commons, ebook readers, and the future of reading.
So, Cory, you've obviously had quite a lot of success licensing and distributing your own books through Creative Commons, but also having them published by Tor side by side. But I think for a lot of publishers and writers at the moment, it's hard to imagine the future and imagine how many more writers are going to be able to kind of capitalize on those same opportunities. And I just wanted to ask you a bit about how that process has worked for you and what the advantages are for you of publishing in this way. And you know, obviously you are quite technically adept. You're a kind of activist for Creative Commons and you've been writing about this stuff for ages. But for the majority of writers who may have gone through a more traditional publishing model, how do you see more and more people kind of starting to take advantage of this opportunity?
I don't really know anyone who's ever done the theoretical traditional publishing model, which there's kind of a master narrative of publishing, which is that you write some things, you put them in an envelope, you send them to a publisher, they publish them, you start to earn a modest living, you continue to write, and then eventually you get to quit your job. I don't really know anyone who's ever done that. I think that virtually every writer of note, every writer who's kind of got a career that is of repute, has had some exceptional stroke or circumstance that led them to where they are. So I don't know that there is such a thing as an average, but you know, it's like sure. Physicists sometimes tell jokes about the perfectly spherical cow of uniform density. The theoretical writer who has the average career, I don't know those writers, but I think a more important point is the extent to which Creative Commons is a mechanism for bootstrapping publicity and sales for work, and to the extent to which it's a mechanism for magnifying publicity. Mm. Now, in my case, I think it did both for a couple of reasons. One, as you say, there's an ideological fit, and I'm an activist for this subject, and so I have an inbuilt audience of people who actually care about this stuff, for whom the fact of Creative Commons was itself noteworthy, especially given that I was early on in the game there. And so I won't deny that played a part in my writing, just as there are many writers who've had similar areas where they published in a domain where they already had some infamy or some note. You know, the entomologist who publishes some groundbreaking work of fiction about ants. You know, that's a familiar story, and in fact it's something something that agents know when they shop a book to a publisher, and something that publishers know when they shop books to the sales force and to retailers and eventually to readers. It's part of the story of the story, if you will. But in addition to that, there's a knock-on benefit of Creative Commons that I think is available to everyone, which is that Creative Commons allows people who like your book and want to evangelize it to their friends and tell them a story about why they should read your story. It gives them a very persuasive tool, which is the book itself. So yesterday I did a talk in Birmingham at the European Python Conference, and Python being an open source programming language. And at the end, it's kind of a gimmick, but also because I think it's good sales stuff, I said, I have three copies of my last book here. And you said it was Tor. I should mention in the UK, it's HarperCollins publishes sure. my books here. And I have the three HarperCollins books, and I said, hold your hand up if you'd like a copy of this book, but only if you'll promise, if you enjoy it, to email a copy of the book to five friends. Right? So, I don't know about you, but if a friend emailed me an entire book, pasted it into a message, because books aren't that big, you can paste them into email messages, and sent it to me and said, here's the book I think you should read, and here's why, and maybe even pulled a couple of paragraphs and stuck them at the top and said, can you believe this, and doesn't that remind you of that time, and so on, I'd probably give the book a good peruse. I wouldn't necessarily buy it, but it would certainly be an important means of kind of roping me in. And that's a kind of, that to me is the kind of you know, platonic ideal of what a Creative Commons license can do. It allows two people who are not physically proximate or who are to connect with each other, pass a copy of the book along, and explain to them why they think the book will be good. And I think for the vast majority of readers, and particularly the
that's that kind of word of mouth which publishers are always seeking to, you know, desperately trying to...
All the retail research says that it's the single biggest predictor of whether someone will buy a book. Word of mouth is one, recommendation from a trusted source. The second biggest predictor is enjoyed a book from that writer before. So you kind of get both, right? If the word of mouth convinces you to buy this book, then having liked the book might convince you to buy a subsequent one. So it's kind of you get that double blessing there. But I really feel like when my books are distributed in this way, or rather when books are distributed in this way, if your audience is less geeky, ironically, it's even more apt to generate sales, because the less geeky you are, the less apt you are to read the entire book off the screen and just to shoot the printed volume altogether. Although, in my experience, geeks are perfectly willing to go to Amazon and spend a tenner on a book. I suppose
following from that, you know, what I think what publishers are kind of worried about in some ways is the moment when, you know, you have an ebook or you have a reader which is attractive enough to kind of, you know, be a viable alternative to buying the book, the paper copy of the book. I mean, do you imagine a kind of iPod moment for books? Or?
I don't really, at least not in the short to medium term. I think that one indisputable characteristic of a very popular, widespread book reader is a very low price point, and we're nowhere near it. Mm-hmm. None of the e-readers are getting anywhere near there, and it's not because of the cost of the fundamental components, it's because of the scale of the product's audience. Reading isn't a mainstream activity in most of the world.
The great irony at the moment seems to be that the people who are buying them are actually agents and editors to store their manuscripts on.
Well, yes, exactly. My agent loves these things. And that is kind of living in the bubble, right? It's the bubble of living in publishing, and so therefore you do a lot of reading, you have a need for a device like this, you often have electronic text shoved at you, you know, all of that stuff kind of, that book is really made for, that device is really made for you. But in terms of, you know, what will convince punters to pick up an ebook reader, I just think, for one thing, it's going to have to be a lot cheaper. And I don't think it's going to get cheaper because of cost, fundamental reductions in the cost of the materials. I think it'll get cheaper only at scale. And reading isn't widespread enough to reach that scale. And so what you'd have to do to bring that scale up, I think, would be to introduce other features, right? Like a Kindle that could also be a great iPod and a great Nintendo DS and a great, you know, phone would be, at that price point, would make a lot more sense. As soon as it does all that stuff, I don't think that it'll be very good for reading, because every time you hit a paragraph that your eyes slightly glaze over on, it'll be, I wonder if there's anything on my email, which is why no one reads books off screen. You need the iron self-discipline of a monk to accomplish it. So I just don't think that it's a big problem, but let's stipulate that I'm completely wrong. And tomorrow someone ships an ebook reader the size of my head for a tenner that weighs 3 grams. In that world, how are we going to stop people from electronically distributing texts without permission anyway, right? You take a book, you drop it on a scanner like that one over there that costs, you know, 100 quid, that has a bulk paper feeder, and a couple hours later out pops the electronic book. We know this, right? We know when J.K. Rowling refused to release an e-book of the last book in the Potter series, Harry Potter and the Sequel of Great Profitability or whatever it was, and... it took 24 hours for that book, from the midnight when it was released till that book was completely scanned, converted to text, and OCR'd, and cleaned up and sub-edited. It took another 24 hours for it to be translated into German by fans, right? So this is like a very fast, easy process. It's not as easy as ripping a CD into MP3, but just like ripping a CD into MP3, only one person needs to do it. Before everyone has access to it. So in that world, it'll be very game-changing in ways that we haven't really thought through. Mostly what's going to be very game-changing about it is that you're not going to be able to exclude people from an electronic text coercively. The only way you're going to be able to do it is by appealing to their better nature, essentially.
And I think that brings me on to something else, which is that I don't think... it was interesting at London Book Fair earlier this year, where four of the heads of the major corporate publishers or fiction publishers in the country were talking about this subject. And three of them, their attitude to this was very, very defensive, and to say we're going to clamp down, we're going to introduce DRM, we're going to stop this. Only one of them seemed to be asking the question, in this future, what is the role of the publisher? And there was an article in Wired magazine this week, and it included the sentence, we need to stop thinking about the future of the publishing industry and start thinking about the future of reading, and by implication, the future of writing. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that, obviously you've already done that, and that's what you're thinking about. But for these industries, for these kind of big players who have so much invested, there's this kind of huge, there's this kind of difficult barrier for them to get over in kind of thinking about the scale of this change, I think.
Well, so the thing is, anytime a publisher says we'll solve this problem by adding DRM, they're not paying attention. Because I'm not talking about ripping the DRM off books, although I think people will do that quite handily. I'm talking about taking the printed book, slicing the spine off of it, dropping it on a scanner, and half an hour later, having an electronic copy. And there is no DRM for your eyes, right? And so if you can read the book, you can render the book in an electronic text. Publishers know this. They do it with their back catalog because there's a lot of stuff in that wasn't born digital that they want to bring back, and they have to turn it back into an electronic text so they can turn it back into a physical object. They do it all the time. They understand very clearly what the mechanics of that are. Google has shown us where that price bottoms out. Project Gutenberg has shown us that individuals on a non-commercial cooperative basis all over the world are able and willing to participate in it. It's just not in the... It's not in that universe. At the risk of digressing a little, XKCD had a great comic about the Diebold voting machines, which are notoriously unreliable, breaking down because there had been a fault in the antivirus software. And the XKCD strip revolves around the fact that having antivirus software implies that they're plugging these machines into the internet. And the question is if you need antivirus software for your voting machine, you're doing it wrong. And he said it's like the teacher of your 8-year-old announcing that he always teaches while wearing a condom, right? It's like, if you need a condom to teach safely, you're doing something wrong in the classroom. By the same token, if you need DRM to stop people from, if you think DRM is going to stop people from getting your electronic text, you haven't really thought through your threat model. You're living in a world in which the threat model is that it is transcendently difficult to make electronic text out of printed text. It's not. Mm. And it just can't. It won't be. It will never get harder to make electronic text out of printed text. So, sorry, I just one more thing I wanted to say, which is that apropos of this, what does the future of publishing look like? I'm about to do a little experiment with this. Both my short story collections were published with mainstream, well-respected literary houses. That it's not something that the big houses do, but it's a good mid-size house. And so I kind of saw what that looked like. And the one that did my last one, which had bought out my previous publisher, went belly up right afterwards. And they've been bought out since. And their corporate parent is not buying new short story collections. So I have another collection's worth of stories. And I was trying to think of what to do. And decided what I would do is a collection of stories that would be empirically examine what it looks like to strike out without a publisher at all, and how far you can leverage it. So I'm doing five POD editions with five different covers. I'm going to print on demand. I'm going to do a bespoke hardcover, 250 units, and then this stuff. You'll see these envelopes on my desk. These are paper ephemera from writers like William Gibson and Joe Haldeman and so on. All the writers I admire are sending me their old report cards and teaching notes and manuscript bits. Those will be the end papers for the books. And then set it into an embossed section on the cover will be a little SD card with the audiobook and the text. The audio is being read aloud by all my friends who are voice actors. So Will Wheaton's going to do one, Leah Laporte, and so on. So there'll be all these audio things as well. It's all CC licensed, it's all available for free, and you can also donate if you like the text, because that's something I've never done with the printed books, because that cuts the publisher out. And what I'm doing is I'm going to publish the financials for the book and compare them month to month to the financials for the last short story collection. And because it's POD, I'm going to bind them in as an appendix. So every month you'll get, the book will be one appendix longer with all the financials for the book to date. And I'm booking that income on three columns, works for me, works for everyone, and works once. And it's going to include things like the income that I'm getting. Publishers Weekly's bought a column based on it. So I'm going to do a column based on it, and that income is going to go into the sheet and so on. And really see, really, really push the boat out on what you can do with POD and self-publishing. And kind of do the apples and apples comparison. If you're a writer like me, and you do everything you can to promote a book that comes from a publisher, how much money do you get?
Yeah.
If you're a writer like me, and you do everything you can to promote the book on your own without the publisher, how much money do you get? And get some data points nailed down, so we're not just talking about what our intuition tells us, but we're talking about what the facts on the ground look like.